Hello and welcome to another episode of PhD Pending, the podcast for early career humanities scholars. My name is Anne Mahler and I have a PhD in English literature. Together we will deep dive into different aspects of PhD life and explore what it really means to do a PhD in the humanities. This week's episode is part two of our supervisor special, so if you haven't listened to part one yet, I'd recommend that you pause here and skip back to our episode from 2 weeks ago, where we talked about choosing a PhD supervisor that's right for you, how to write a banging PhD proposal, and how the whole process looks like through the eyes of a PhD supervisor. I hope you enjoy part two, but before we dive in, I wanted to say a quick thank you at the end of the season for all your support. Thank you so much for listening to our episodes, following us on social media, and a special shout out to everyone who has donated to the show on our Buy Me a Coffee page and is subscribed to our Patreon. And speaking of Patreon, before we come back with another regular season, you can get exclusive bonus content on there. So what does that look like exactly? We hear from our former guests about what they've been up to, and by popular demand, we get an insight into the PhD research of some of our guests. And as you might have seen on our Instagram page, I have just started a new job as a secondary school or an America high school teacher, so you can expect some extra content on the transition from PhD to teaching and the ups and downs of this transition. But now, without further ado, let's get back to our supervisor special.
And in terms of what you've done, this reaching out part, you got in, you've written your PhD application, all of this is going well, and then you start your PhD, you start your research, and then inevitably you have supervisor meetings, right? I remember ours were quite regular. We would meet, I can't even remember, like maybe like once every month was a lot. We wouldn't meet that often.
No, maybe once every 6 weeks or so.
Yeah, I think. Yeah. And what was great is that if something ever came up where I felt like I needed immediate help, I always felt supported because you were always there.
Yeah.
You were like, yeah, let's meet like this week or next week, or like, let's tackle this head on. So what are some of the do's and don'ts you think in supervisor meetings? Have you had supervisor meetings that you were like, okay, so this is not how this is supposed to go, even in your own experience as a PhD student? When back in the day?
Yeah, no, I always had very good, as a student, I always had very productive meetings. I mean, I didn't meet with my supervisors all that often after the initial, it is that thing where in the initial stages, you're going to be meeting more often.
Yeah.
And apart from anything else, during the first few weeks and months of the PhD, we tend to have the students doing their IRC applications, which I see a look of horror just coming over your
face. I just remember as much
as it's another trauma flashback, isn't it?
As much as I remember you telling me the PhD thesis is just a means to an end in terms of the viva, I remember very clearly in that very first pre-meeting that we had, you need to hit the ground running. You need to hit the ground running.
Yeah, right.
Dramatic repetition in my head IRC.
Yeah, but so we would have quite frequent meetings to begin with, certainly because we would generally be working on that IRC application as well. But also just at the beginning of the PhD, you do need more frequent meetings because you're establishing the kind of groundwork of your research, and there's kind of more to discuss. So I think as you reach the end of your first year, when you're beginning to draft full chapters, then it's more a case of you know, having discussed all this stuff with your supervisor, you're taking some time away to actually draft the chapter, which, you know, obviously does take time.
Yeah.
And then it's, you know, getting the draft in a reasonably decent state sent to the supervisor, and then you're going to meet and discuss that. But if there are things along the way, then I would always say, you know, go away. You're drafting that. You've got a deadline. Try and meet that. If you're struggling to meet that deadline, let me know in advance.
Yeah.
If there are particular things you're struggling with, email me. Give me a shout in some way or another, and we'll discuss it and try and push it through. And I think that generally works well. So, you know, I think there is this idea that there's this kind of model whereby you should be seeing your supervisor every month,
mm-hmm.
which I can see, like, if you're working in the sciences, maybe that is necessary, and maybe you're working with your supervisor every day in a lab or whatever mm-hmm. anyway, so you would have much more contact. But I think the common sense approach, certainly in sort of literature PhD, is that there are times when you're not going to be seeing your supervisor all that often because you're going to be away drafting.
Mm-hmm.
And while you're doing that, there's no point, you know, just meeting your supervisor for the sake of it.
Yeah.
So, less frequent meetings during the kind of middle period, I suppose, of doing your PhD.
Yeah. Would you have PhD students tell you, okay, so I work best under deadline pressure.
Yeah.
Give me more deadlines, please.
Yeah.
Like, and how far do you try to find out what the working style of your PhD supervisee is? And do you match your supervising style to that in terms of, like, meeting frequency or checking in or all of that?
I do to a certain extent, but it's very much regarded as good practice now to be drafting from a fairly early stage.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, you and I know that you know, if you're going to be good at writing, you need to be writing fairly constantly. You get out of the practice with writing,
mm-hmm.
and it's difficult to kind of regain the momentum if you don't keep it going. So, you know, most people are happy enough doing that. You might still encounter people who want to sort of read and then do the so-called writing up period at the end, which was the old sort of 40 years ago way of doing a PhD.
Sounds very scary. Would you not forget everything?
Well, yeah. It's. I mean, this is why it's regarded as good practice now to be doing reading, writing, and do the two together. It's far more productive as well. Because, I mean, you get ideas through writing as well. So would I adapt? Yeah, I mean, I'd adapt to a certain extent. And you know, if people want to set deadlines, then yes, definitely mm-hmm. we'll set deadlines. And most people do want to do that to a certain extent.
Yeah.
It's helpful to do that as well, because then I can block out time for, if I know when a draft is coming in, then I can block out time for reading it and getting back to a student. Because I think it's only fair that unless circumstances get completely in the way, you should try and get back to a student as soon as possible with feedback on a draft. Let me ask you this, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would tend to do comments and corrections and track changes, that kind of thing, on chapter drafts using Word. And I think what we tended to do was I would send you that back before we'd actually have a meeting, so you'd have a chance to look over what I did. I think that's probably the most useful way of doing things, rather than sort of hitting you in the meeting with that kind of thing.
Definitely.
Because then, you know, you could respond to comments and questions that I'd raised in drafts.
I honestly preferred it that way because, again, like you said, it gave me the chance to read through the comments first.
Mm.
But then also for some things it's obvious, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's like, this doesn't fit here, this paragraph should go there. This quote doesn't quite work here. I don't see how you make that connection. Like, some of those things are very obvious, but some were more like discussion points.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so let's talk about this. Is this, like, does this theory make sense here?
Yeah.
If you apply it like that. And then we would have a discussion about some of the criticisms, right, and some of the recommendations. And I thought it was great to have the comments first because it almost saved us an entire meeting because I had a chance to review that and then also argue my case almost. And then we came to a consensus of what's best for the project.
Yeah.
And to me, at least, I think that was the best way to do it. And the track changes were great too, I think. We only had to do it like once where you gave me like paper comments.
Yeah.
But again, that wasn't really a problem either because I would just rewrite everything in the draft anyway.
Yeah, I've moved much more to doing track changes and comments now because I think that just works so well. And like you say, you know, the comments thing is useful because then you've got discussion points for the meeting as well, and you can prepare and we can usefully, as you say, kind of thrash through.
That's it.
Particular issues.
That's it. And I think what I would always do as well, and I remember that especially for my second chapter, which I think I rewrote about 3 times, that I would also let you know, okay, so this is something that I struggled with. like that this chapter didn't come easy to me. Where I'm unsure about what I did.
That's very useful for a supervisor, actually. That's a really good point, that if you're sending a draft to a supervisor, the covering email can be very, very helpful in drawing attention to particular bits that you're not sure about or bits that you struggle with. You did that, Sarah did that, certainly. It's very helpful to provide a bit of focus for my reading.
Yeah, because, like, obviously you want to, like, make sure that you hand in the best work that you can, but then you also have to have this level of, like, trust and honesty where it's like, I don't think this is my best work, but can you just see if that makes sense?
Yeah.
That kind of thing. And
If you get an email from a PhD student saying that, you know, I don't think this particular part is working properly, but I've worked and worked at it, and I can't seem to get it to work. Have a look at it. Then that's really, you know, that's useful signposting, and that's something that can be used for a productive discussion at the next supervision meeting.
Yeah. No, I think that was, and I really like the track changes, and I think at the start, and I do also understand that, especially if you have like 15,000 words to go through, or doing that on the screen is quite taxing.
Yeah, so I've sort of resigned myself to that, because the benefits of track changes and comments outweigh the fact that I don't like reading on the screen, but I just have to force myself to do it now.
Yeah. Not great. It wouldn't be my favourite either, so I understand that.
Yeah.
So sometimes even just going through like the papers, and I'm like gesturing or flipping through papers at the moment as I say this, it's like there was something satisfying in like ticking off your comments as I was editing. It forced me to engage with the text on a different level almost, and on my like forced me to focus on my own writing in a different way.
Mm.
And seeing it then, I was like, what the fuck was I doing there?
We'll do it.
So, that was definitely very, very helpful. And are there any, like if we talk about do's and don'ts in supervisor meetings, are there any don'ts that you ever come across? Anything where you were like, this really should not be happening at a supervisor meeting?
I'd say, in a way, I would be uncomfortable if the supervisee is taking everything I said as gospel and not challenging it and not engaging in discussion regarding what I'm coming back with as corrections rather than suggestions. Put it that way.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. You want to have that discussion, right?
Yeah. I mean, PhD supervision in general is a really, really one of the most enjoyable parts of the job, I would say. And so you want that kind of give and take. You want something back from your PhD supervisee, who's you want them to be engaged with the project. If you are.
Yeah.
So you want them to kind of argue their corner a little bit.
And in terms of,
I think we had discussions like that, didn't we?
Oh yeah, of course we did. I think especially around the Gothic chapter. We did have some back and forth, because I think I also wanted to extend the idea of merging the two to like other texts, and I think you and I had a bit of a disagreement around, can you apply these new theories to 19th century texts? So I really loved that, because it really forced me to think about what was forming in my head, and I thought was great.
Well,
to be like, do you know what? No, actually.
I mean, in a way, that's another thing, because, you know, in some ways, the PhD supervisor-supervisee meetings are also preparation for the fiver as well, because you know, part of what you're doing in those meetings is defending your approach or defending your work or justifying it. And to a much larger extent, that's what you have to do in the fiver.
Speaking of traumatic flashbacks, we'll get to that in just a second. Just in terms of like to round out the supervisor meeting kind of bit of the discussion, in terms of international supervisees and like cultural differences, is there anything that you've come across? Because obviously I'm from Germany, you're from England. I think the only real issue that we ever had was that our supervision fell right into the World Cup 2018 thing, where Germany did horribly in terms of football for American soccer. And I heard a lot of very nice comments about the German performance.
Wow. See, I could mention I could mention Leipzig losing 5-0 last night, but I wouldn't go so low. cultural differences. I don't know. I mean, it's more in some ways the PhD process and the Viva process varies a fair bit from country to country.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose we've had American students coming over, and the PhD process in America is vastly different to what it is in most other countries, because there's the huge reading they have to do and
the comms and
yeah,
it's a way
yeah,
longer
yeah.
process as
it's
well.
It's a much longer
yeah.
process. Like the thesis seems to sort of come in much much more towards the end there
yeah.
than it does in Europe. So I don't know. I mean, it's not something I've really encountered very much, having to deal with in those ways.
Yeah.
Sorry, it's a bit of a lame answer, but it's just yeah.
Apart from the lively discussion around football.
Well, indeed, yeah, which is always welcome. Yeah.
What was it, 1961, the Wembley goal?
66.
Oh, 66. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
And
at least you didn't put goal in air quotes. So.
Now that we covered kind of supervisor meetings and all of that, and also communication outside of meetings, right? Because like,
yeah.
you would write emails. It's not that you fall off the face of the earth
yeah.
for like 2 months.
It is important to keep in regular contact and just, mm-hmm. you know, if you are... Like, you know, if you're struggling to provide a draft, or you know, let your supervisor know in plenty of time,
mm-hmm.
Because you know you are an important but small part of your supervisor's overall concerns.
Yeah,
you've got, you know, research and
yeah.
loads of teaching and other PhD students that they're supervising. So, so you don't want to piss off your supervisor by, you know, not providing work when you agreed you were going to provide work and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Or you know, if that is the case, if you're not going to meet a deadline, let them know well in advance and
yeah.
renegotiate a deadline. Because these things happen, you know. Real life intrudes. We all know that.
It's almost like submarine PhD students that only pop up every once in a while and then
yeah.
they disappear again.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
have you ever had that where, you know, a PhD student just fell off the face of the earth, never to be seen for like... months and months on end, and did you have to do chasing, or how does that work then?
Yeah, a little bit, and to be honest, I would do a limited amount of chasing,
mm-hmm.
simply because, you know, you're an adult as a PhD supervisee,
yeah.
And I'm not going to treat you as a child who needs to be coerced and you know, chased after.
Yeah.
So, you know, if something like that happened, then I would send an email.
Yeah.
And if I didn't get a response to that, then I'm not going to be sending loads more, probably.
Yeah.
And if, you know, maybe that sounds a little bit harsh, but don't have time to be chasing after people who, you know, are, as I say, grown adults. And again, I know real life issues do crop up, and I'd be, you know, completely sympathetic. And you know, normally if that happened, you would send that email and somebody would come back to you apologetic saying, yeah, sorry. And that's fine, you
mm-hmm.
know, and we can take things from there.
Yeah.
But yeah, that staying in contact is important, and just, you know, it's an issue of courtesy on both sides.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're right. It's a different kind of relationship in terms of when you're on the PhD level. It's more. It's still not eye to eye, but it's a bit more eye to eye than for your undergrad thesis or. Maybe even for your master's thesis.
Yeah, I mean...
You're your own person, it's your project, kind of, it's your responsibility, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's an important thing of doing the PhD thesis, is taking ownership of it and taking responsibility for it.
Yeah.
Which is not onerous, I don't think. It's something you should have pride in as well, that, you
mm-hmm.
know, this is my project,
mm-hmm.
and it's valuable because X, Y, Z. You know, one of the things we haven't talked about is conferences and things like that. But
yes.
I think conferences are important while you're doing the PhD for a number of reasons, for getting, you know, useful feedback from outside your supervisory team. But also, you know, meeting peers, sharing experiences.
Yeah.
But also, you know, explaining your work and explaining why your work is important, explaining why your work is engaging and getting other people to be excited and engaged about your work.
Mm-hmm. Academia is a discourse, after all.
Yeah. But you encountered that at conferences. I mean, you had a really interesting project that you know, people were interested in. Yeah.
No, definitely. Again, it comes down to what kind of conferences you go to. Then I think I did encounter it, but I was, especially at the very start, I feel like the first year of my PhD was me running around like a headless chicken, just in circles.
That's not that uncommon either, I don't think.
Yeah. So I definitely had those amazing discussions, but yeah. I was so busy running around
didn't have the composure to kind of absorb what people were saying.
I probably didn't really take it in.
Yeah.
At the time, again, something that I think I would have come more into my own if I had taken a bit more time.
Sure.
Not in terms of like writing the thesis, but in terms of engaging with it on like more community level,
so doing some of the sort of extracurricular stuff.
Allow myself more time for that. Obviously I had to finish because of, you know, financial pressures, mm-hmm. and my funding would be running out after 3 years, have to finish at that time.
Sure.
And I was also done kind of at the end of the 3 years.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's that community aspect, I think, that and you were always very, you know, structured about this, and you're like, okay, so we need to do conferences, we need to, like, let's go to this one, let's make sure we get this one, and
But you were proactive as well. I mean, you found a good range of places to go.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, your supervisor can give you some advice
on
that, but also, you know, it's just worth keeping an eye out and looking on the various calls for papers lists and that kind of thing to see what's about.
And now that I think of it, it's the same for publications, isn't it? Because one of the things that I really appreciated was that when I started to look into what we talked about earlier in terms of like merging my two research interests in terms of Gothic and 19th century and trauma, is that you took it upon yourself to also read something that I wrote that wasn't part of my PhD. Mm. For one thing, because I really value your opinion and I really value your input, but I also wanted to hear, like, okay, from a critical standpoint, does this make sense? Because it feels a bit out there to me.
Sure.
So even now that I'm finished with a PhD, we still talk about, okay, so you could publish here, you could publish here, you could do this. So there's also this kind of helping hand, and obviously you have way more experience, you know way more about the publishing landscape.
Sure, yeah, right. To a certain extent. And I mean, it would vary, I suppose, from supervisor to supervisor, the extent to which they feel that's part of their responsibility. But
yeah.
I think, you know, with a healthy supervisory relationship, you would generally, I think, expect your supervisor to take a look at, a look over a conference paper, for example.
Yeah.
So, you know, especially if you haven't delivered one before.
Yeah.
Or take a look at an article which is, you know, maybe coming kind of tangentially out of the thesis rather than is strictly part of it.
I
think that would hopefully be a part of it, usually.
That was definitely something that I really appreciated, and that was really special, because I know I was pushing my luck with the topic as it was. Yeah. So I felt like there's something in there, but I needed some, you know, some input from an expert.
Yeah.
Almost. So, that was a great help. And if we kind of move focus a small bit now to, I suppose, a bit more difficult question. And again, I mentioned that at the start of our conversation now, and I've mentioned it in other episodes, that now I have a lot of colleagues and people I met at conferences and friends who dropped out of their PhD, who first took a leave of absence or completely dropped out immediately. I feel like the more I think about it, the more like people I can think of that actually did that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not 50-50, I'd say, but it's a good 2/3, 1/3 kind of situation. And a lot of that came down to, okay, so either the project falls through or there was an issue with a supervisor.
Right.
There was some kind of difficulty and I'm asking you this not as a supervisor yourself, but more probably in your position as the Dean of Graduate Studies, and I'm sure you came across these cases as well. And so this issue of what if a supervisor-supervisee relationship falls apart or is strained, and what are some of your recommendations for someone dealing with a failing supervisor relationship? Are there ways to, like, get the relationship back? Or one of my friends, she actually described it as a breakup.
Yeah.
And she actually said to her supervisor in that meeting,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to break up with you now. I'm breaking up with you. Which I found was quite interesting.
There's a couple of things. I suppose that the first thing would be to address it as early as possible and not let things get really bad. If you feel that the relationship is not working, if you can talk to your supervisor about that, and you know, if your supervisor is reasonable enough to try to re-establish things, then it'd be better to kind of address that as early as possible. The other thing, I suppose, from you know, specifically from this university's perspective, is that one of the things UCC has done actually quite well, I think, in terms of grad studies, is that there are structures in place to try to address this kind of thing. And the principle is that this is kind of escalated from smaller scale further up the chain to every stage, try to involve someone to help to resolve relationships. So, for example, you know, if there is a problem with your supervisor, you can take this to your head of department or head of school, or to, or to the chair of the graduate studies in the school or department. You know, if it can't get resolved there, then you can go to the Associate Dean of Graduate Studies in the College of Arts. Then there's also the Dean of Graduate Studies for the university as a whole as well.
Right.
Who's very approachable too. So that, so there are various levels that you can take this to if something isn't working out. And, you know, the changing supervisor or adjusting the supervisory team is, it's not that common, but it's also not unheard of at all. I mean, it's not something that's happened that I'm aware of very much in English. But certainly I came across it when I was doing the associate dean role for the college. There were students who changed supervisors in other departments, or even changed from one department to another. It was departments that were slightly kind of allied. And sometimes that would be a problem with the student-supervisor relationship, or sometimes it would be kind of the project changing course, so other supervisors were drawn in. So there is that flexibility for changing supervisors in the system. But obviously it can lead to kind of fallout. You know, like inevitably the supervisor who is discarded is likely to feel a bit slighted by this.
That makes sense.
I mean, it's not a nice situation to talk about, really, and thankfully, you know, touch wood, it's not one I've sort of encountered during the course of PhD supervision, but yeah, so I suppose that principle of trying to address it early and not letting things fester is quite important.
And it's nice to know that there's flexibility in the system to accommodate these changes. It's not that you have your supervisor and for better or for worse, you're kind of stuck with them, right?
I think it's a recognition that it's the real world. These things do happen. These relationships don't always work, or they do deteriorate. And so the university has to have some kind of mechanism in place that it can be addressed.
Yeah. If we progress further in the supervisor-supervisee relationship coming towards the end of the PhD, obviously the viva then is coming up, right? We had, I remember, more frequent meetings because obviously the write-up happened, the hand-up happened, I handed in. We had discussed finding an external... an extern for the fiver, and that was something that you did, right? We had discussed a couple of people, but then that's usually what the supervisor does, right?
Yeah, it varies from one project to another, really. I think it's just something that the supervisor and the supervisee discuss together, and I'm just kind of looking back over the various ones I've done, and it's difficult usually to pinpoint exactly who came up with the examiner and whose decision it was. I mean, ultimately, I suppose it is down to the supervisors to decide from maybe a range of options.
Yeah.
But like with Kieran, for example, it was his very much his suggestion.
Right.
For a particular external, simply based on the fact that he's engaged with his work a lot during the course of writing the thesis. It was not a critic that I knew at all.
Right.
But it worked out really well. Like, yeah. he's a very good external. And sometimes it'll be someone you know or know vaguely.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's more difficult if, you know, it's particularly difficult, I suppose, if your first choice external is not available or not willing to do it.
Yeah.
Then you have to start going down the list and finding people who are perhaps less closely allied with, you know, either the research that you're doing or the perspective that you're arguing from.
Yeah.
And it can, you know, I mean, it can be a problem.
Yeah.
If you get an external who perhaps is a bit of an unknown quantity and who takes a particular objection to a theoretical approach that you are taking.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's difficult because I mean the examining team is generally. The internal examiner isn't going to be necessarily the kind of expert in your area. They might know a bit, whereas the external, in theory, is going to be someone who really, you know, knows that field very well. That's why they're chosen. But yeah, it is always a bit of a shot in the dark, and you don't quite know what you're going to end up with. I mean, having done this a few times now, I'd say I would always pick the quite. I wouldn't say elderly, but someone quite well into their academic career, I'd say, because they are likely to have more experience of examining PhDs, more experience of the Viva process, more experience of what is actually expected of a PhD thesis, whereas a young, more inexperienced academic might be going in with higher expectations, I think, of what a PhD thesis is supposed to be, and they might be kind of overly rigorous, I think, in terms of what's kind of required.
Reminds me of when I started teaching and the way I would be grading and the way I'd be grading now.
Exactly that.
Would be different, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My poor students in a very first term I was still at the German University.
It's another one of the PhD initiation processes.
Yeah.
Your first batch of marking and correcting comes as a bit of a shock.
Yeah.
It's just like, Jesus.
It's this power that you yield all of a sudden.
it's a bit of a shock sometimes, the standard of the work. Not what you were expecting.
Yeah. Oh, God, yeah. Those first year essays, Jesus.
Yeah.
In terms of, like, the Viva, because obviously, I mean, you had great Viva experiences for, I'm going to say, all of your supervisees, bar myself. But well, ours
not,
was...
Not quite, but yeah.
But ours was special in terms of, because it was virtual, right?
Yeah.
But also just like in general, so I can't speak for in-person ones.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, because you are there, but you're not really... talking, right?
Yeah.
It's not really your position as the supervisor
yeah.
to be engaging during the Viva, as far as I understand it. What kind of is the feeling as a supervisor when you kind of see a little duckling PhD supervisee walk their way through the Viva?
Well, just to say, yeah, in the Viva, the way UCC has it set up now is that the people attending will be obviously you, the PhD student, the internal examiner, the external examiner. Sometimes there'll be an extra external examiner, if you know, depending on the project or whatever. I think if it's a member of staff, they have to have two external PhD examiners. There will be an independent chair, who is a member of staff, usually from the College of Arts, who won't have read the thesis. They are there purely to ensure that the procedures are followed properly, and your supervisor or supervisors. In fact, it's purely optional up to you whether you have your supervisor. And the norm is that the supervisor would be there.
Yeah.
that's the norm here. Like in England, it totally wasn't.
Yeah.
The supervisors weren't there at all. It was just you and the examiners. But yeah, the norm is that your supervisor will be here. It's somewhat peculiar because the supervisor is there but not taking a real speaking role. They're there,
yeah.
I think, just for clarificatory purposes.
Oh,
and especially okay. in the kind of discussion when the candidate has left the room before the judgment is made, if there's something that the examiners need to clarify with the supervisor, then they can do it then.
In terms of like context or...
Yeah, I suppose context.
Like,
yeah.
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 But it's minimal, the supervisor's role in the exam. Early on, I used to take notes.
Mm-hmm.
But I've not really done that so much recently. Take notes to give to the candidate. But I found that was probably slightly limited use.
Yeah.
So, yeah, didn't I've kind of stopped doing that now. It's just... it's a peculiar role for the supervisor. It's a peculiar experience actually seeing it and not really being able to say very much.
I can imagine.
Yeah, I mean, you can try and help out, I suppose, if the candidate is really kind of floundering. But I've never had that experience really.
Yeah, I just remember a couple of times during my viva when some of the questions would come up, and obviously I had everyone on the screen.
Yeah, yeah.
And in my head, I knew I was going through kind of like a, not difficult, but it was like a testing experience. Like,
yeah,
it was.
You were given a hard time, I think, based on the thesis. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose you could.
Yeah,
you could
external,
say that.
The external was rigorous, let's say.
And it's funny because like from everyone else, or like just around me. Or even like on Twitter, I read stuff. Oh, you know, I had the most amazing viva and like great discussion and such an uplifting experience. And then I look at mine and I'm like, okay, I remember you saying right from the start when I first started my PhD, you will submit and when like you fully agree that I can pass the viva.
Yeah, yeah,
that was all. I always knew that there was never a time where I would submit and you wouldn't be fully on my side saying this is going to go through.
That's the ideal. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah.
I mean, according to the regulations, candidates can submit their thesis against the wishes of their supervisor. And this is something, this is one of the things, for example, that the supervisor would probably mention to the examiners when the candidate has stepped out from the viva, if there are discussions saying, not sure, you know, then they might ask the supervisor.
Because it's also going to fall back on you to a certain extent, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because the examiners are otherwise going to assume that you have put your kind of stamp of approval on the thesis when you might have been advising the candidate not to submit.
That makes sense, yeah.
Yeah.
And I just remember when I was going through the viva and like I was hit with a couple of specifically like hard questions or questions that I didn't necessarily expect. And there was this one point when I was asked if I wanted to take a break, and I said no, because I'm not sure if I would have come back to this situation, right? And I just remember a couple of times, like, looking up to, like, where your part of the screen was, and I could just see, like, micro reactions on your face, depending on what the question was.
Yeah.
And that gave me a lot of reassurance because I was like, okay.
That's good.
He thinks it's a bit of a left field question as well.
There.
So it's fine.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to deal with it, kind of. It was very reassuring.
I think we're talking about cultural differences, and I think some of that was a bit of a cultural difference in terms of the expectations of a continental European PhD examiner. They were rather rigorous, and yeah, certainly left field is the right term for some of the questions I think you asked.
Yeah.
That was yeah.
But yeah, I can imagine that it feels, that is a funny feeling to like not really be able to say anything during the viva.
Yeah, it's a peculiar setup.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have you had a moment where you were like, where you really wanted to say something, but you couldn't?
Yes.
Fair enough. Short and sweet answer. We'll just leave it at that.
We will. It wasn't your viva. Yeah.
obviously then, you know, the viva is done. If everything goes well, the viva is passed. You have the corrections, which are not really handled by the supervisor as much as they are intern, right? By the internal examiner.
Yeah, yeah. It depends on the level of corrections. Mm. So I think if it's minor corrections, then the internal supervisor is largely responsible for them. And then if it's major, they both have a look at it. And there's various judgments available. Like, you know, there's horror shows where it might be rewriting significant chunks of the thesis and having another viva. Very rare. But yeah, the look of horror. But no, these are vanishingly rare. I mean, much more usual would be either pass no corrections, pass minor, or pass major.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. And then obviously, then technically, right, the supervision process ends.
Yeah. You've got to set these ducklings loose at some point.
And then, you know, but then what is your kind of philosophy in terms of that supervisor-supervisee relationship? Because obviously you spent a good chunk of time together, like 3 to 5-ish years, depending on where you are, depending on how long the project took.
Sure, yeah.
Like, what's your philosophy on going forward after that then?
Well, that's, you know, I mean, ideally it's nice to stay in touch. I've stayed in touch with, to a certain extent, with most of my ex-supervisees would be, like, you know, sometimes just through Facebook, sometimes, you know, more closely. Like, you know, it's not that long, but we've kept in touch with Kieran, and I'm still in touch with, for example, Ross, who's teaching in Qatar. So I've had some, you know, sort of send the odd email to each other there. So yeah, I mean, it's just nice because, you know, it's a kind of relationship that has developed over a number of years, as you say, and by the end, you know, you're probably quite close to someone if you've had a good experience of the supervisor-supervisee experience. You know, it's quite nice. It does turn into a kind of friendship after that.
Which is really nice. And
yeah.
It's like, it's really nice because it takes away that pressure from you have to finish, like, a certain project.
Yeah.
Which is, like, obviously the structure that you're working within at the time.
Yeah.
Right, but then there's also the rapport that you build kind of outside of that.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. It's not something I've really thought about before, but I mean, it's like you've gone through something fairly unique together.
True.
I think.
Yeah.
And you might have scrapped a bit along the way, but you've come out the other side hopefully successfully, and you know, I think that is the basis of a kind of friendship, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you know, you'll have a lot in common, obviously, because you've got huge amounts of intellectual interest in common. So, yeah.
That's true.
Yeah.
So, that's kind of the end of the supervisor-supervisee relationship. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you think is important to mention?
I can't remember what you were talking about before we started this. It was something about... No, I don't know. I think we've covered most of the things, really. Yeah.
Quite an in-depth.
Yeah. I mean, I did want to mention the whole thing about the thesis being a means to an end. I think that's the absolute golden bit of advice I was given at the start, and it's one I've striven to pass on to other new PhD students.
Definitely. And it kind of took the pressure. When you first told me that, it kind of took the pressure off this perfectionism aspect.
Yeah, for me too.
Of the written thesis.
I mean,
it really took that edge off almost.
Yeah, it's the effect it had for me as well.
Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah.
Well, the two last questions, and they're a bit quick fire, right? Questions that I ask every guest.
Okay.
Number one, what's some advice that you would give to your first year PhD self?
Ha! What is that? It's, I mean... but. That is the thing, really. Yeah. The don't strive for perfectionism.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And luckily, I was given that advice as a first year PhD student. So, you know, I'm trying to think. Like, I mean, for me, the PhD process was unusually smooth. I think I had a really good time doing it.
Mm.
I mean, there were times when I got a little bit stuck, and certainly, my final chapter. I'd written all the other chapters, and I got to the final chapter, and I thought, I have no idea what I'm going to do with this. So I did something a little bit left field, and that worked out fine. So I did get a little bit stuck there, but it wasn't really a case of needing advice.
Yeah. I had the same thing about my last, like, with my last chapter.
Yeah.
Up until I had to start writing it.
Yeah.
I didn't know what I was going
to
do.
I just decided to do a whole kind of Marxist reading of this.
When in doubt.
When in doubt. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, I should have done a Marxist reading of what you were doing. I'm sure I could have pulled something together if I had wanted to. And the very last question.
Sure.
In terms of productivity, what is your favourite productivity hack?
Productivity hack. I suppose one of the things is connected with this whole means to an end thing again. Mm-hmm. Actually, as I was writing around the computer screen, I would have various post-it notes. But one of the post-it notes I had was a message to myself, just saying, "Don't get it. What was it? Don't get it right. Get it writ," which is just if you're struggling to perfect a sentence, paragraph, whatever, don't, you know, just.
Yeah.
Do it, get it down, get the basic idea down and move on. Keep the momentum going.
Yeah.
You're always going to be revising stuff. You're always going to be perfecting stuff. So it's something I really, like to this day, force myself to do. I just force myself to write a first draft, get the ideas down, and then, you know, I'll leave something a couple of weeks or whatever and come back to it, and then you can be quite savage with it and come back to it with fresh eyes and revise it. But yeah, that thing of just ploughing through, forcing yourself to write, knowing that it's not perfect, knowing that this isn't exactly how you had it in your head, but it'll do for now, you know?
As long as you have the first draft down, like that's
the better. Hard, that's the hardest bit.
Yeah, that's better than a blank page, essentially.
Yeah, definitely. I don't know if that's a productivity hack. It's just...
Well, it is kind of like, it's more like mind hack, isn't it? Because, like, it helps you get over yourself a small bit.
Absolutely, get over yourself. Just having that post-it note there. And occasionally, you know, I would find myself thinking, oh, shit, I can't get this right. And I think my vision would go to that post-it note and be like, yeah, do you know what? Just move on.
I actually think that's brilliant advice, especially what you were saying in terms of keeping the momentum.
Yeah.
I think having a proper momentum and being like in a proper flow.
Yeah.
And not just writing flow, but also when you have a good research flow over a couple of days where you just like really, where everything falls into place and you pump out the work and it just like works.
Yeah.
You don't want to interrupt that
by
overthinking certain things and like taking yourself out of
that
flow kind of. So
yeah, the other thing I had, I don't do it so much now, and perhaps I should. I used to have this thing because I had back problems. I used to have this thing whereby I shouldn't really be sitting at a computer writing for more than 20-25 minutes at a time.
Right.
So I'd actually set a timer, hit that, and that was actually really good for productivity because you'd see it ticking down. You only had 5 minutes left and you'd be writing like crazy. And I could find that I could get, you know, double-spaced perhaps a page of A4 done every 20 minutes or so, which is really good rate because you've got that kind of time
pressure on you. You're kind of forced to do it.
Yeah. And also, I mean, this is probably fairly hackneyed advice, but also don't be afraid to leave right in the middle, you know, get up when that beeper goes.
Mm-hmm.
If you're right in the middle of quite a good flow, because then it'll be easier to get started again because you're in the middle of that flow.
Yeah.
I always try, if I'm writing and I need to take a break, I try not to finish a point. I try to leave it in the middle of something I'm quite sure about so I can get started
again
and go back to it.
It's one of the things that I did as well, more like on a micro level, in terms of like trying to get back into workflow the next morning.
Right, yeah.
Would have like this tiny task of like type up this quote, and as soon as I typed up the quote the next morning, my brain would be like, oh,
yeah,
let's write this down, let's talk about this in the quote, let's analyze this about the quote, like,
and that's then a nice idea.
Then you can scoot right back in instead of procrastinating for an hour and a half trying to get back into that flow. So that's actually really good advice.
Yeah
Okay, amazing,
good.
I think we've covered loads in the last hour and a half. Alan, thank you so much for your insights. And
you're
also
welcome.
Thank you for being an amazing supervisor.
Well, thank you.
And it's great to have had you on for the special. So thank you very much.
Pleasure.
And obviously I got you a little something.
Oh.
My original plan, right, was to get the entire family football jerseys, but I feel like I was scared that you would revoke my PhD. So it's just a little bottle of wine from Germany.
Fantastic.
for you and Brona to enjoy.
Riesling, lovely stuff.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So this is it for our Supervisor Special and Season 7 of PhD Pending. We'll take a bit of a break now, but don't worry, I already started recording new episodes for Season 8. For any and all updates, make sure to follow us on our social media. And as always, I'd love to hear from you. So reach out with any questions or if you just want to share your experiences. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at phdpenningpod or send us an email to phdpenningpod@gmail.com. And like I said at the start, for updates and bonus content, you can also follow us and subscribe on our Patreon. Thanks as always for listening, and I'll see you again soon. This episode of PhD Pending was written and produced by me, Anne Mahler. Artwork by Jerome Kelleher. Support the show and rate us 5 stars in your favorite podcast app. You can also subscribe to our Patreon for exclusive bonus content, or if you prefer a once-off donation, head to our Buy Me a Coffee page. The links to both are in the show notes. You can find the show on Instagram and Twitter at phdpenningpod or send an email to phdpenningpod@gmail.com.